out of it, was just giving us some extra leeway as far as production is concerned, as far as production tolerance. Can we carry the formula even further? I'm positive the answer is yes. There's a whole class of antennas out there the world has never seen, simply because every antenna manufacturer today, let me drop, every antenna vendor I know of today has a false impression as to how good antenna modeling is. When it comes to skinny diameter radiators, the antenna modeling programs do an excellent job. When it comes to very broad width radiators, multiples of them like dipoles and Yagis, the modeling programs cannot do it because all of these vendors of antennas brag about the fact they model it first and then build it. As such, they will never find this. The ham radio operator who is a real good tweaker and an empiricist, a guy who likes experiments. I guess there's a couple of finest people throughout history have said one good experiment is better than 1,000 theories. When you sit in front of a real good vector network analyzer, where you're getting 30 sweeps per second across the frequency range of interest, and you're looking at the result of your antenna in real time as you're tweaking it with tuning tools, as you're holding your hand near it, as you're holding a piece of copper near it, or whatever, you're getting the answer so fast. You're getting an answer in the 30th of a second. If you're doing it by computer modeling, every time you make one of those changes, the computer program would have to run for an hour to try to figure out what happens, and it would only be giving you a rough approximation. When we got the final antenna, and I took a couple of guys who were very good at computer modeling. Let me drop. I said, okay, I want you, here's the exact dimensions that works. There's the results on that screen. And we thought at first that we were just getting a funny result out of Roden Schwartz. So we went over to an Enritsu in the vector network analyzer. And then we went over to an Agilent or a Hewlett Packard. And then we installed it on a real piece of electronics that needed that very low VISWR. In all cases, we got confirmation. It wasn't just a quirk. It's real. But the computer modeling programs, when you model that antenna, it didn't even show you you were in the ballpark of a good antenna. It gave you a trend toward a wide antenna. It told you that this wire was as good as a 15 dB reflection coefficient. The real coefficient we were getting was over 30 dB, and the computer program didn't know that. Wonder what you think of all that, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW. K2RIW,
K2EJ. You got me thinking. Oh, by the way, if you give that design to a mathematician, right? Computer modeling software for antennas. Give them the basic information on how it works, that is, if you know, then you can generate a program which will do the job. But anyway, I've got a question for you, because now I'm trying to visualize this. It's a loop and a dipole, and you did mount it on a substrate. By the way, did you use both sides or just one side?
The substrate was a flat piece of clear plastic. I think it was Mylar. I only used one side. There was a whole bunch of wide pieces of copper tape. The dipole was not a flat-out dipole. The dipole was bent downward like a longhorn antenna. So the dipole tips were bent down. Across the center of the dipole was this loop made out of very wide chunks of copper, this loop antenna. And at the junction between the two, at the center, it was being fed in the center with a dipole, with a balancing device. And at that point, there was a pair of stray capacitors, or tunable capacitors, across that very wide gap in the center of the dipole. And the placement of those capacitors was part of the magic that made this work. So the right shape of the loop, the right spacing to the loop to the dipole, the right shape of the dipole, the right tuning down of the tips of the dipole, bending down. When I say bending down, I'm talking about a planar structure. The whole structure would lay flat on a piece of table. When you look at a top view, the tips of the dipole were bent down from your top view, if you know what I mean. So once you properly placed all of the copper and the tuning dipoles, you got this fantastic performance, which at first we didn't believe. We thought it was a quirk of the vector network analyzer. We also we tried modeling it with a CST Studio. We tried modeling it with HFSS. There's various versions of HFSS where you can enhance it, where it puts a whole lot of extra finite elements into the program. Let me drop. We did all of those procedures. and the answer got a little bit better, but nowhere near did it get showing us the performance we were really getting, because the total number of finite elements would have been thousands. And you try to take a matrix of finite elements, where you've got thousands of finite elements all being fed, all being calculated in the complex manner of a amplitude and phase angle, and you keep track of all of that as you invert that matrix. None of the available programs can handle that today, Eric. Could it be done tomorrow? Of course. But the available programs today, I don't think, can handle this one. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2LIW,
K2EJ.
Engineer Kelly the reason why I asked is that when you first described this, what I envisioned was, how a dish cone operates, would have, let's call it two arrowheads, one arrowhead inside of each other, where at any particular frequency, there was spot between those two elements, competing balance and resonance. So I think something like an arrowhead with a loop in the center of it, just trying to visualize how that becomes the radiator itself.
A really interesting spot. Sorry about the low audio.
What the modeling did show us, that the current density is greatest around the perimeter of the wide piece of copper that is the radiator. Very similar to what happens with the fingers that you put into a high-frequency transistor. High-frequency transistors, the source, drain, and gate, or the emitter and collector and base, are all done with a whole bunch of interstitial fingers that fold into each other, and all the high frequency action takes place around the perimeter of the fingers. So high frequency networks behave that way. Mother Nature, whenever you get a wide conductor, you would think the middle of the conductor is doing nothing and only the perimeter of a flat wide conductor is doing all the work. Well, the middle is doing something. You need it. If you completely eliminated the middle, you do sacrifice some of this performance. So that's some of the hints we got as to what's going on. So it was a combination of coupling in three-dimensional space between the loop and the dipole. I'm talking about the radiated coupling combined with the real physical coupling, because one was connected to the other. They had a common junction at the center. Combined with the right kind of layout, the right kind of width and bending at the right positions, and these gimmick capacitors, when you put that all together, boy, can you make a broadband antenna. And the computer modeling program for that antenna, if you try to model it as a simple LCR network, let me drop it. The magic of wide conductors where the perimeter is doing most of the current density radiating is that the equivalent inductor and the equivalent capacitor of the individual elements of your models are not fixed as a function of frequency. And so all of the fancy computer programs and the equations that people have worked up before, for instance, the Bode-Fanno equation, the Bode-Fanno criteria, that's the maximum bandwidth you can get out of an impedance matching network that you add to an antenna. It is all based on fixed components. In the real world, Mother Nature's components are not fixed. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2LIW, K2EJ.
Well, actually, I guess my interest was piqued because I've been going over Kent's website, and, you know, I'm trying to make I've got a large piece of PC board, and I want to make a disc. I'll start off by making a UHF Yagi, so I'm more interested in directivity than anything else, because essentially I want to spin the disc. And eventually, I've been thinking of ways to make like a folded Yagi to be able to do it in 2 meters. So, I was interested in what you're describing, and I just out of curiosity, is the dipole and the loop, are they fed separately? Are they both balanced? Do they relate to one another? Because I'm still trying to figure out what's the best way to couple into a 70 centimeter Yagi laid out on a PC board.
Because of that work that I was doing for a 10-year period of time, on RFID handheld devices, where we needed as much directivity as we could get into a small package. And we were using three-element Yagis built out of very broad elements. And we did have quite a significant sit-down with the Fractal Antenna Company in Boston. And they were relatively sure that by fractal techniques, they could shrink down the size of the dipole, shrink down the size of the Yagi, and give us the same amount of gain in a smaller package. They really did believe that. Turned out not to be true, or at least they weren't able to find the solution that they thought would exist. The bottom line of all that is when it comes to Yagi-like structures, I'm convinced you cannot get gain without making an investment in real estate. You can do various things to a three or four element Yagi to shrink down its size. Shrinking down the length of the elements, yes, you're allowed to do that. And you'll take a hit as far as bandwidth is concerned. The Q of the structure goes up when you do that. But when it comes to the real directivity, front-to-back ratio, front-to-side ratio, main load to side load levels and whatever, you have to make an investment in real estate, length of the boom. You start shrinking down the length of a boom of a three or four element Yagi, and you start sacrificing the directivity. So you got to make an investment in real estate, as I see it, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, well, you know, directivity is a number of elements. By the way, I had the thought of the fractal, and I kind of wanted to ask you about a few things about that. I know they're somewhat successful at the cell level, but I wonder if it works at lower frequencies. But my idea is I'm not really so worried about length. I could actually have a boom that's, say, 3 feet long. But the, you know, directivity is going to be number of elements, not the length of the elements or how the elements themselves are. The way I would get around 2 meters, let's say I was building it on a piece of PC board, is that I could actually divide the elements up into multiples of quarter wavelength and literally fold them one on top of each other and electrically connect them together. At least that's my thinking.
You're not alone in that thinking, Eric. There's a lot of people who thought that they stack a whole lot of dipoles, a whole lot of parasitic elements along a boom that they could get higher gain. Good sounding theory. And if you believe the Yagi worked as a multiple element filter-like structure, it would seem to make sense. In reality, it doesn't work that way. Gunter Hawk, DL6WU, has spent most of his lifetime studying the world's best Yagi antennas and modeling the real thing and testing them in that anechoic chamber he's got in Darmstadt, Germany. And he's got a whole lot of articles in the German magazine on that exact subject. He has arguably the world's most respected formula that'll tell you what gain you can get out of a long Yagi antenna. The formula is based on only length of boom, not the number of elements. As long as you've got a reasonable distribution of elements, not too many, not too few, as long as you've got a reasonable distribution of elements, his formula, you feed into it raw data of how many wavelengths of boom you're using. Let me drop it. You give his formula how many wavelengths of boom you're using, and it tells you what amount of forward directivity you are able to achieve. Gain is length of boom. And you could double the number of elements, or you could half the number of elements, and if you adjust them correctly in their spacings and lengths, you'll keep coming back to essentially the same gain. I mean, you're not going to make a 16-foot long Yagi on 432 with two directors. You know what I mean. It's got to be a reasonable number of distribution along the boom. But once you properly set them up, the boom and all of those parasitic elements constitute a slow wave structure with a particular velocity profile. Once you achieve that velocity profile of along the length of that boom, you achieve that forward gain, that forward directivity. So just doubling the number of directors on a boom. If you start off with a well-tuned Yagi of a given length, and now you just start adding a whole lot more parasitic elements to them, you think you're going to get more gain. His formula says no. His experience says no. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Oh, I understand that. My mind is thinking, I remember that there's depending upon whose design it might be, the direction of what you need to be exactly point two wavelengths away from each other, and you know, the given spacing that people have that kind of optimized for the game. But listening to what you're just saying, so let's say I have an antenna, just for the sake of it, a 10 dB gain antenna that goes 2 foot long. So in essence, I could take two of those directors out and get the same performance?
If you retune the spacings and lengths of the remaining directors, as long as you don't carry it too far, you'll come back to the same gain, yes. And when it comes to front-to-back ratio, be careful how you judge that, Eric. I could build you an antenna that on paper, or in reality, has a fantastic front-to-back ratio at one particular point in space off the back of the antenna. You look at the antenna pattern as a three-dimensional object. It'll look like an apple. And where the stem of the apple goes in, you get this little bit of a dip. So if you go to that one magic spot in the back lobe of the antenna, you'll measure a fantastic front-to-back ratio. You move a couple of degrees in azimuth or elevation off of that point, you're off of the stem of the apple, if you know what I mean, and all of a sudden the front-to-back ratio is terrible. Real front-to-back ratio is where you integrate the total amount of energy in the back hemisphere compared to the front hemisphere and compared to the main lobe. So you can easily fall into a trap of a particular tuning that gives you 30 dB of front-to-back ratio, but that's only one particular point in space at the stem of the apple, if you know what I mean. It may not be significant. It may not be real. There's more going on here than first meets the eye. K2EJ, K2RIW.
All right, K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, at first glance, when you're looking at the pattern, you know, I'm envisioning, okay, this is a cardioid, where the highest front-to-back ratio is right where the, you know, the thing comes together in the back. Right? Now, if you take and turn it into a ball, which is like a three-dimensional device, which is really it, that's where I guess the apple fits in, or a pear, what have you, in terms of being able to visualize it. Now, in the application that I'm looking for, I'm really just wanting to know on a horizontal plane, I want to know where the peak is and where the null is. Because if I spin the antenna, then I'm actually tracking it with a counter, taking the value off, not necessarily the AGC, but what's feeding the AGC. And I'm using that to determine where maximum signal strength is. I don't necessarily have to concern myself about above and below the horizon.
We have to accept the fact, Eric, that every antenna produces a pattern in three-dimensional space. Once you take that three-dimensional pattern, which maybe looks like an apple, and you take a slice through the apple, and then display that on a flat piece of paper, we get the conventional antenna pattern as far as what we see as the manufacturing data, if you know what I mean. Well, that's just one slice through the antenna, through the real pattern. Every antenna has a three-dimensional pattern. It's really radiating some energy above and below the horizon, to the left and to the right. The front-to-back ratio is not a point in space. It's the stem of the apple, so to speak, but there's really a great big hemisphere of energy out there at other angles. So you could represent it nice and simply. In the case of an antenna that's above Earth, and you know you're getting a certain reflectivity off that Earth, quite often somebody will plot the pattern saying, this is the antenna pattern. If I take a slice at a 30-degree angle above the ground, 30 degrees in elevation of the antenna pattern, because of the ground performance, if you know what I mean. And so that gives you one nice piece of data. In fact, the doctor is in the last couple of months, has displayed some of those patterns. Let me drop. Where because of ground reflection, the peak of the beam is really 20 or 30 degrees above the horizon. And he gave you a two-dimensional plot slicing through the three-dimensional antenna pattern at that elevation angle. And it gives you one very good piece of information. But there's a lot more going on. And as you start building longer Yagis where you want high performance and state-of-the-art front-to-back and state-of-the-art forward gain and state-of-the-art side lobe level, there's a lot more happening. One of the articles that I'm pretty sure is on Mike Number 2's website, Mike Number 2 is K1MJM, That's the website of LimarTechNet.com. There's an article in there about maximum gain you can get out of a Yagi, written by K2RIW. And the bottom line of that article is that almost everyone believes that your main lobe of your antenna may have main lobe efficiency of 85%. Well, what do they mean by that? Or the horn has 85% or 65% efficiency. Your parabolic dish has got 55% efficiency. What does that mean? I put 100 watts into that antenna, 99.5 watts is radiating to space. It looks like it's got 99.5% radiation efficiency. When they're talking about horn and parabolic dish efficiency, they're talking about the gain you realize compared to that exact size of antenna if it was being run with uniform distribution. If your magic feed horn could smear your RF energy equally across that whole parabolic surface and abruptly fall to zero at the perimeter, no spillover energy. Let me drop. And if there were no bumps in the parabolic surface and no phase errors in the feed horn, that would give you 100% efficiency. Because you can't build a horn with that much control of its primary pattern. The primary pattern, the best you can get in most cases, that you adjust the horn so that the perimeter of the dish is getting 10 dB less energy compared to the apex of the dish. That's the best you can do for high efficiency, high gain, and a slightly different number for lowest gain to temperature ratio, more like 15 or 20 dB of edge illumination. Anyhow, your aperture efficiency might be 55-65% on a good dish. Everyone believes that the so-called wasted energy, the other 35%, is in the side lobes. It is not. And you think if you do some kind of fancy tuning so that you make the side lobes go to zero, you're going to get 100% efficiency. Good sounding theory. Absolutely not. That's not the way it works. The highest gain efficiency of any parabolic surface that mankind has ever built is the parabolic surface that's used for a Newtonian telescope. There you've got a parabolic surface that has a 20th of a wavelength of accuracy. You've got the equivalent of a feed horn, which is the eyepiece, which is giving you uniform illumination taper. It's got 9,000 wavelengths of diameter. The eyepiece, it can do that. And the parabolic dish itself is 300,000 wavelengths of diameter. So you can now achieve nearly 100% efficiency of that antenna. 90-some-odd percent is achievable. Okay? You take that so-called diffraction-limited optical telescope, which is the exact same electromagnetic spectrum, just at a much higher frequency than the radio waves that we use. It's got nearly 100% aperture efficiency. And now you study its so-called airy disk antenna pattern. You'll find out the first side lobe out of that antenna is 13 dB down, the second side lobe is 17 dB down. I'm talking about these rings that you see when you look at a star. A point source you look at of a star, you're going to see these rings. And you're going to have only 85% of the energy is in the main lobe of a 100% aperture efficiency parabolic dish antenna used as a telescope. The side lobes must be there because of the laws of diffraction. And you think the wasted energy is in the side lobes. And there's a bunch of guys that have used computer modeling programs on Yagi antennas looking for that magic efficiency, that magic performance, magic design, where the side lobes will disappear. In the case of a parabolic dish being used at a radio frequency, let me drop. You can taper the energy as it goes toward the perimeter of the dish. That will lower the side lobes. But you lose gain in the process. The side lobes are not wasting energy. The highest efficiency antenna in the world must have those magic numbers of those side lobes. If it's a round parameter, a round aperture antenna, like that telescope, that first side lobe, that first ring of that airy disk will be 15.5 dB down, the second side lobe, 17 dB down, third one is 21 dB down, and so on. Those magic numbers will be there. You can make those side lobes stronger, you'll lose gain. You can make those side lobes weaker, you will lose gain. You can make those side lobes that exact magic, those exact set of magic numbers, you'll get the maximum gain out of the telescope. The side lobes have to be there. Easily misunderstood. Lots and lots of people have gone down that road, wasting their time. It's time we stop the insanity on that particular one. KE2EJ, but you built some telescopes in your days. I think you've grounded your own mirror on one occasion, didn't you, Eric? K2RIW on the TechNet. K2RIW,
K2EJ.
Yeah,
You know, funny, the inverse of what you're talking about in terms of aperture, like on a 9-meter TVRO dish, because you're talking more translating, but on the receive side, you know how the spillover happens. You go back a whole lot of years when the phone company was told to do that. And a couple of days, we had to put these, literally you had to put these covers, it's like a wall on the end of the dish to bring the offending RF down for another good 30-40 dB. You know that feed horn is seeing more than just the bursts of the dish. Off of the reflection coming off the edges of the parabola is nowhere near perfect. Yeah, where was I going to go with this? Okay. Given the application that I'm talking about, all right, essentially I want to have a spinning antenna, and I can fight things with a computer in terms of knowing what the characteristics are, and using that to create a mask or a model, so to speak, as to what the actual antenna is doing, barring any multipath or reflections or stuff like that. What would you recommend?
I presume we're discussing a VHF frequency, and this exact problem existed on a very major program where it's called the E2C aircraft, which has a great big pancake on top that spins. They want the highest possible gain, the highest possible main lobe to side lobe level. They wanted the least amount of ambiguity as they rotated that antenna in order to locate emitters. And what's inside of that radome is a very carefully tuned array of Yagi antennas. Big Yagis in the center. You've got this great big horizontal bar with a whole bunch of Yagis on it. The Yagis in the center along the Yagis near the perimeter of the dish are shorter. They're all very carefully tuned. The radome itself is carefully tuned. And when you do it just right, you get very low side lobes, fantastic front-to-back ratio, fantastic forward gain, one very nice pencil beam in space that rotates with that antenna. And so for you and I to build a Yagi-like structure that we can mount on, say, the top of our automobile, put it in some kind of a radome if need be, and spin it, is probably going to give us the mostest for the leastest, in my opinion, particularly if you're smart enough to make the antenna that you're spinning gravity balanced so that it's not wobbling the mounting structure, the great big magnets you got sticking to the roof of the car, and you rotate that thing with the right kind of a computer program backing it up. I think you would even be able to eliminate the ambiguity created by multipaths, if you know what I mean, as you drive along. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, the first phase of the experiment would be in a fixed location. I actually have access to vibration measuring stuff, so if it is on a substrate, weights being put in the appropriate place, and weights can be non-conducting, even non-metallic, due to balancing. That's the easy part. Coupling the connection to a solid piece of coax that leads off to a receiver, that's a whole other issue, but I've got four possible different solutions to that. Driving it from the center, that's a whole other issue, but I've got one of these motors that used to, if you remember back in the late 60s, early 70s, there was something called a Shlomo disc that they used in sports. Huge thing that had two huge rhodium platters that had little heads that contacted it. And it recorded analog video for 30 seconds on it. Have the motors from a motion. You think of the weight of those discs. This motor will spin any. K2RIW, K2EJ.
Sounds to me like you've got the hardware, just gotta properly apply it. There's a zillion ways of making a contacting or non-contacting rotary joint at the center of the spinning antenna. There's various ways that you can make contacting and non-contacting multiple coaxial cables going through the center of that rotary joint. The radar people have done that for years. Balancing it, rotating it, using the right kind of shaft encoder so you know where it is at each instant of time, being able to speed it up, slow it down, make it go in the other direction, make it searchlight some particular direction, all of that's doable. The electronics is there. Modern day brushless DC motors, which really are the equivalent of stepper motors in the old days with the right kind of a driver network, oh, they can do magic. These guys that are powering these radio-controlled model airplanes with brushless DC motors where they're getting lots of kilowatts of energy out of those things for 10 minutes at a time, boy, can they do things. Reverse that prop if you want to in milliseconds and spin the prop so fast the tips of the prop are breaking the speed of sound on these real blaster radio-controlled model airplanes. Boy, does that make a funny sound when they give it a burst of energy for a couple of seconds where the tips are breaking the speed of sound. When you watch a model aircraft doing that, or you watch a smaller version of that go into a vertical climb and climb out of sight in 7 seconds, you realize what kind of power you've got in modern-day rotary machinery that's being properly fed with the right kind of a computer network. So the stuff is there, Eric. Just a matter of properly applying it and have some fun. Sounds like you got a good project. I think we got to go on to the mailbag. John, are they going to stump us this week, those geniuses that mail you these letters with these really tough questions? KC2WGB, K2IW, the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Maybe, Dick. All right. First question comes from the chat room. A gentleman named James, I believe. KD2, golf uniform. Sid. All right. He has a question. Have you ever heard of anybody developing an antenna using mini blinds? You know, the vertical blinds? I believe they're vertical. I know I have. Maybe you have some experience and you can explain how that's done, Dick. Back to you, KC2WGB.
Okay, so James is asking us, can you make an antenna out of something that looks like Venetian blinds? Absolutely. There are lots of antennas where you've got a bunch of horizontal bars to the reflector or to a shielding device. It's either in the antenna or part of the parabolic reflector. And the horizontal bars will reflect the horizontally polarized wave. A vertically polarized wave will look at those horizontal bars as a thoroughly transparent structure with just a little bit of stray capacitance in space. It'll have very little impact, if you know what I mean. If you offset those 45, those horizontal bars at a 45-degree angle, you can now make a reflector which will rotate polarization of the signal it reflects. And so there are ways of taking horizontal pieces of wire, embedding them into the reflector of a parabolic surface, and it becomes a simultaneous reflector and a repolarizer. You can build all kinds of tuning networks into the reflector structure of the reflector. And if you go one step beyond that, let me drop it. You can make a frequency selective surface which acts like a parabolic reflector, even though the surface itself is thoroughly flat. Now, when it comes to building a transportable antenna, where the antenna is a whole bunch of these panels that you take out of a suitcase and you assemble them into this flat structure and put a feed horn in front of it, and that flat structure acts like a parabolic surface electronically because of the network you have embedded in that surface, the tuning structures that you've embedded in there, the frequency selective surface. So it can be acting like a parabolic reflector, it can be rotating polarization, it can be frequency selective. You can do all kinds of fancy things with step and repeat structures that you bury either in three-dimensional space or into the structure of your reflector. I know I went pretty far off center to the original question, but I thought this would help a little bit, John. KD2, here we go. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Just to cover it a little more fully, he did not ask this question, but what problems might he have trying to tune that up? I don't know what frequency, he didn't mention frequency, but about tuning it, how comfortable do you think that would be?
I'm setting up horizontal bars as a reflecting surface. They do not have to be tuned. Horizontal bars will reflect the horizontal polarized wave that hits them. Whether they're too short or too long doesn't matter. They will reflect it. If you start resonating them, life gets a little bit more complicated. That may not be exactly what you want to do. So horizontal bars reflect the horizontal polarization. They're thoroughly transparent, primarily, to vertical polarization. So no tuning is required. There are parabolic dish antennas. We've seen them. They look like chicken cooker antennas. 802.11 antennas are built this way, where the reflector is made out of horizontal bars that are bent into a parabolic shape. They are not tuned. The only real tuning required is that the amount of wavelength of spacing between the horizontal bars and the diameter of the bars determines how much energy feeds through. If you made the spacing between the bars too wide, some of the energy feeds through the spaces between. If you make the spacing between the bars too narrow, you end up with a lot of wind load and a lot of weight and a lot of extra cost. So there's a happy medium between the two. There is a chapter, let me drop. There's a chapter in the Antenna Engineering Handbook near the back, which allows you to rate reflecting materials. In the case of chicken wire-like material, the size of the hexagonal holes in the chicken wire determines at each frequency how much energy feeds through. And I'm pretty sure there's a similar set of graphs in there that'll show you for simple horizontal bars what spacing of the bars is required for how much energy feeds through. You probably want the energy to feed through to only be a couple of percent. And that sets a certain wavelength between the bars of a certain diameter. As the diameter of the bars gets larger, you can use a slightly larger spacing between them before the energy starts feeding through, if you know what I mean. Could look at the spacing between the bars as a piece of waveguide beyond cutoff, and the thickness of the bar represents the depth of the waveguide, the length of the waveguide, is one way of looking at it. So there's a whole art and science to properly setting up a Venetian blind-like structures to act as a reflector or as a shield within an antenna. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Okay, very good. Well, if he has any further questions, maybe he'll send it over to the chat room and we'll take it from there. All right, let me let it drop and I'll go on to this little construction problem. Okay, I've had a few emails going back and forth between me and this gentleman. He's building a Faraday cage and he has set up a test and he wanted you to give your opinion of what he's constructed here. He has a copper box, which is five-sided, and inside of that, he puts a battery-operated transmitter. Okay, and when he completes the cage, it rests on a copper plate at the bottom. My only recommendation to him was to get a better seal at the bottom instead of soldering it, because he has to keep opening this thing. I had him put a few fan stock clips, about six of them, not to be used as fan stock clips, but to be used as finger guides, and it worked out pretty well. So when he presses it down, he gets a fairly good seal. All right, now, he has a power meter approximately a meter away from it. Inside the Faraday cage is a transmitter with an antenna. Then that whole compartment is closed up. His power meter with the antenna 1 meter away. The power meter itself is located with another 3 meter cable, so he's got quite a distance between the actual instrument and the device he's testing. The maximum dBm attenuation he could get was -113. Do you think there's any way he could improve on that, Dick? Back to you, KC2WGB.
I'm trying to remember the equivalent of a Faraday shield they had to build for the oscillator assembly on the jamming pods that were used on the EA-6B aircraft. The Navy EA-6B standoff jammer had these great big long pods that hung under the wing, and there was an exciter assembly in the middle of the pod, and the forward end of the pod had a transmitter, the back end of the pod had a transmitter with an antenna built into it. and you had to make sure that the signal radiated by that antenna didn't get back into the oscillator and send the whole thing into a feedback loop so that you no longer had control of the frequency it was radiating. And they had to use double and triple shielding, and I think they were getting 110 dB or so of shielding out of each layer of shielding. If he's getting 113, he's doing quite well. However, evaluating the 113 to come up with the quantitative number, there's a whole rigmarole you got to go through on that one. Let me show you what's going on. Let me drop. The best example I can think of is that in the early days of Airborne Instruments Laboratory, roughly 1970 time frame, I'm working for the Microwave Instruments Division that was building a so-called power oscillator. And that power oscillator could be tuned from, I seem to remember, 50 megacycles to 2,000 megacycles, and it would put out 50 watts of power. And in order to test it, they had a broadband horn that they were putting the signal into and aiming the horn up in the air. And somebody was worried about the fact that as you go to various frequencies across that range, you're hitting various commercial services, FM radio and television and data channels and whatever. They were worried about creating interference. So somebody came up with the idea, okay, we'll drill a hole in the side of the screen room. We'll put a piece of coax cable through there. Why they didn't use the one that was on the baffle, I don't know. And they'll put the horn antenna inside the screen room, so that now they're radiating the signal out of the horn into the screen room, and it's no longer interfering with the outside world. Good sounding idea. It didn't work because, let me drop. The screen room was a thoroughly conductive cage with no lossy materials inside. Therefore, all the signal radiated by the horn went out, bounced off the walls of the screen room, and came back to the horn. Therefore, the horn was running at an extremely high standing wave ratio when it was in the cage, when it was in the screen room. Out in free space, the horn gave you a 1.5 standing wave ratio. In the screen room, it gave you something very high. Therefore, the free-running oscillator with a very high standing wave ratio was very difficult to control to get it onto the right frequency with the right power output. The bottom line of all this is that when you're transmitting inside of a screen room, unless you're transmitting through a 10 dB pad, so to speak, the transmitter is going to see weird amounts of standing wave ratio, and the real power being radiated is not what you think it is. As such, if you reverse the procedure, if you put the transmitter outside of the screen room and you've got the receiving antenna inside of the screen room, at least as far as the disturbance of the transmitter is concerned, you're better off. But you've still got a problem. The receiving antenna, it would like to have a nice low standing wave ratio, so it makes a good match to the receiver. Whether the antenna in the screen room is transmitting or receiving, the antenna is going to have high standing wave ratio. The good news is that a receiver is more forgiving of high standing wave ratio, and you can calibrate it accordingly, whereas a transmitter is not very forgiving. You try to make a transmitter feed a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio, so to speak, and if your Pi network doesn't have enough antenna tuning range to handle that, the transmitter is going to be unhappy. It's not going to be putting out the power you think it's going to be putting out. So, as you can see, unless you've got a screen room that is an anechoic chamber, which is absorbing the signal that's bouncing off the walls, and in a very small structure, you can't do that. So, the calibrating of the procedure, knowing the real standing wave ratio the antennas are experiencing, and therefore how much energy is coming out of the transmitter, how much energy is getting into the receiver, calibrating is difficult. I'm giving you some of the details of it. And so, let me drop. As such, in the past, electromagnetic testing was always done inside of a screen room. And now the modern day people are beginning to realize the screen room is so highly reflective that you make minor motions of the antenna, the device in the test, or whatever in the screen room, so that the reflections off the walls come out in phase or out of phase compared to the way they used to, you get very different results. And in order to avoid that problem, people are starting to do anechoic testing. They're starting to do screen room testing in a room that is now an anechoic chamber. All the signal radiated by your device on the test, you want it to go from point A to point B, from your device on the test to your sensing device. but the reflections off the walls, you want them to be non-disturbance. You want them to be absorbed. It's only the direct signal you care about. So to make the room anechoic solves that problem. That's the good news. The bad news, unless the walls are a good number of wavelengths away from your device on the test and away from your antenna that's doing the sensing, then the walls themselves and the anechoic material creates what's called resistive near-field loading. It changes the impedance of the antenna. It changes the gain of the antenna. As you can see, it's not a simple procedure. So if he's measuring 113, he's doing very well, in my opinion. However, is that 113 number traceable to the Bureau? I've given you some of the details as to why it might not be. Although there are various ways you can repeat the test with not making modifications in order to...
AC2WGB. Good information, Dick. I was not aware of that, but to make it anechoic, besides the shielding for a room, wow, that is a great idea. All right, let me give you his procedure and see if you think he's going about it the right way. What he did was, before he puts it sitting on the copper plate, the transmitter, and he sets it so that he reads 0 dBm on his instrument. Look, the antenna's a meter away. Now, he'll take and put the box over it, securing it to the fan stock clips, and that's how he's getting the 113. Does that represent a proper method in as far as what he's doing with his method? What do you think about that?
When the five-sided box is put over top of the copper plate and the transmitter is mounted on the top of plate, copper plate, that's the beginning of very good shielding. How good that shielding is now is a function of is every, let me pick a number, quarter of an inch.
Copper plate, by the way, Dick.
Okay, but is every quarter of an inch of the bottom edge of that five-sided box, is every quarter of an inch of that making an extremely good bond to that copper plate? By way of finger stock and by way of folding structures, you can make that happen. I'm not quite sure what you mean by fan stock clips. I've heard that name. I'm not quite sure what they look like. How frequently are they grounding? And if there was an indentation in the copper plate so that the walls of the five-sided box went down into that indentation with finger stock, then I think that the amount of shielding could become even better. And by the way, I presume the transmitter inside is battery operated. If there was a feed-through power connector on the five-sided box that's feeding the transmitter, to stop that wiring from becoming a coupling antenna from the RF energy inside the box to the outside of the box, that is difficult. So if that transmitter inside the box was battery-operated, that would help an awful lot. So the amount of shielding is a function of how good is that bond on the perimeter of the five-sided box. I suspect, carefully done, about 120 decibels is achievable. Much beyond that, you're going to have to put another layer of shielding around the whole structure. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
You're correct in assuming that it was battery operated. Okay. Now, it's all solid copper, and all five sides are soldered for the full length of the seams. So, I don't think... wouldn't that box now be, it's 200 megahertz, by the way, the frequency he's working with. When he makes that connection to the plate, basically the area that's exposed...
RF energy has got some very sneaky ways of getting around things, John. That notch, that slot, where the bottom of the perimeter of the five-sided box meets the copper plate, you'd like to call that waveguide beyond cutoff, and it's going to give you a good number of dB of cutoff, that's for sure. But to really get the maximum shielding, every eighth of an inch of that perimeter has to make intimate milliohms of resistance contact with that copper plate. That's not easy. Gold-plated finger stock with gold-plated edges on the copper would help an awful lot. And the finger stock itself, it's got to be very short finger stock. And the size of the box at 200 megs, is the box itself big enough to be resonant at 200 megs, or is it smaller than resonant? And as such, the antenna on the transmitter inside the box is going to see an extremely poor standing wave ratio when the box is closed. And so, is the transmitter still putting out the power you think it is when it's looking into that extremely high standing wave ratio? There are ways, by the way, of measuring what standing wave ratio is the transmitter seeing when the box is closed. As such, you may think the transmitter puts out 1 watt when the box is open. Because of the extremely high standing wave ratio, it's possible the transmitter is only putting out 10 milliwatts when the box is closed, because the transmitter is seeing 100-to-1 standing wave ratio. I'm pulling numbers out of the air, but I'm showing you what could possibly happen. Over to you, John, K2LAW.
Okay, Dick. Yes, very interesting. That's true. With him upsetting the antenna structure like that, he may not have the power to begin with, so he could be getting a false indication. All right, but the last question on this is, he needs to put something in his box that's going to be getting warm, so it has to be ventilated. He was thinking of making a convoluted slot, something like a waveguide, bent at 90 degrees every 3 or 4 inches for maybe 3 turns. And it's going to be about a half an inch by 2 inches. And it will all be right angle bent so that he can force draft. He'll put one of those on each end. Now, do you think the RF energy could leak out of that? Because at 200 megahertz, I don't think so with the convoluted right angles. But what is your opinion?
Yeah, you're thinking of the RF energy like light waves, and by making 90-degree bends, you think you're helping. You're not. The best way to get air through the box without RF coming back out is to start off with a piece of screening, copper screening, but do a pretty good job, about 100 dB of shielding, 110. The next step beyond the copper screening would be to give the screening some depth. If the screening is made out of, let me pick a number, quarter-inch diameter pieces of tubing, where each piece of tubing is, let me pick a number, an inch long, and you stack together a whole bunch of quarter-inch diameter thin wall pieces of brass tubing. Each piece of tubing, and they're all soldered together, is a piece of waveguide beyond cutoff. Because there's so many of these pieces of tubing, you've got a lot of area the air can flow through, but the RF cannot get down those pieces of tubing. A quarter-inch diameter piece of tubing, 1 inch long. There's a bunch of books you can go to where you can find a graph that'll tell you exactly how many dB of shielding that's going to give you. And maybe the answer is 150 dB of shielding for each piece of copper tubing, if you know what I mean. The diameter of the tubing and the length of the tubing, because they're all waveguide beyond cutoff, will let the air flow through, but will not let the RF flow back out. And making those pieces of tubing straight will do the job very nicely. So where they've got to bring air into a box and they didn't want the RF to come out, that's the way it's usually done, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
KC2WGB. Okay, yes, like chimneys. All right, understand that. All right, that basically covers most of his questions. I wish I knew what he was doing with this, but it sounds interesting. Okay, let me let it drop. And it must be expensive with all that copper. Oh, by the way, the box dimensions is approximately a half a meter cube. I don't know if that makes a difference to you, but half a meter cube. And it's a very small transmitter that he has here. I believe it's a walkie-talkie. It looks like a part of a walkie-talkie anyway, or an HD. All right, let me let it drop, and we'll go on to the next.
Yeah, let's run that one by. Half a meter cube is 50 centimeters on a side. 50 centimeters, the first resonant frequency on that would be around F wave, 50 centimeters. I'm guessing it's around 500 megahertz. So as long as he's below 500 megahertz, it's some funny things will happen. Sounds to me like he's got a box below resonance, and it sounds like a good project. And what you're discovering is that once you launch an RF wave, it tries to go to every cubic centimeter of this universe. And you've got to do some heroic things to stop it from doing that. And the greatest amount of leakage, I believe, is happening where the bottom of the five-sided box is meeting the copper plate. That edge You'd like every quarter of an inch or every eighth of an inch of that edge to have milliohms of resistance to the copper plate. I know that's not easy. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Well, Dick, I think I'm going to email him a little note. I would, instead of using the fan stock clip, that was good for a test, but I think he should go to the door stock that you're familiar with when you close a door on a cage. He doesn't need too much of it. It's not that expensive. He doesn't even have to get gold. He can get copper, I believe, for what he's doing, and that should work well. Do you think that would do better for him? He'd have a full length on all sides.
I believe so. And there are various ways that you can make a crushable material. They make a kind of, what would I call it now? Steel wool is not the right name for it, but they make a kind of material. It's called RF gasketing. The RF gasketing is all something in the vicinity of a 16th of an inch or 3/32nd of an inch thick. It's a conductive rubber gasket, but it's got a whole bunch of highly conductive wires inside that go across the short dimension, so that when you bring two waveguide flanges together with this RF gasket, it makes sure that there's extremely good contact between the two. So there's RF gasketing material he could put on the copper plate, which allows the five-sided box to come down and compress it, and it would make a hell of a lot better contact. So RF gasketing material, if you Google those words, I think Emerson Cummins makes it, but I'm not quite sure what brand name. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
That's a great idea, Dick. I remember using copper braid, which I stripped from coax cable, to seat a Faraday type on. Even something like that might be better than... That would give him complete contact, I think. A little better than what he has, anyway. Alrighty. KC2WGB. Alright, on to the next one. This is interesting. Now, gentleman has a receiver which has transistors in it, and they're little plug-in sockets. He wants to know, he's looked up the transistors and the gain of the transistors that are used. And he was thinking of adding a preamp and going on about it. But what he's found is several transistors that have, under the same parameters of operation, have much higher gain. If he were to substitute these new type of transistors, do you think that would be a benefit to gain overall? Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
I almost don't recommend this one, John. Reminds me of the problem I ran into with the AM radio that was in my wife's automobile way back in the dark ages, where the local oscillator transistor failed. And after a whole bunch of troubleshooting, I found that out. And the transistor that was in there had a maximum frequency of oscillation capability. His data sheet on the transistor was good to something like 10 megahertz. And the first transistor I picked up at AIL that was laying on a bench that no one was using was good to 150 megahertz, so I plugged it in. It had approximately the right amount of gain, input impedance, output impedance, whatever. I plugged it in to the failed local oscillator position on this AM radio. And the bottom line was, as you tune the radio across the band, certain portions of the band you could listen to some signals, and certain portions of the band you couldn't. But what was happening is that this transistor that was good for a couple of hundred megacycles was looking at the stray inductance and stray capacitance of the printed circuit wiring of that radio, finding resonances way up at 150 megs that were not anticipated, and it would take off and oscillate there. It didn't get on about the frequency I wanted at 1.5 megahertz, if you know what I mean. So you start putting in higher performance transistors into somebody else's yucky design, you can get yourself into a fair amount of trouble. Assuming, let me drop.
VE3LNZ, Lindsay, Ontario.
Disconnected.
Looks like VE3LNZ just left us. Assuming the radio was of reasonable design to begin with, and the only thing wrong with it is it doesn't have enough noise figure or gain. In other words, it won't listen to weak enough signals for you. To add a low noise preamplifier in front of the radio, can in many cases give you tremendous performance improvement. And now you're just adding something without changing the design, and sometimes that low noise amplifier that you add has got a built-in bypass relay so that when you're listening to a strong signal, you can turn it off, turn off the preamp. So adding a preamp in front, 90-some-odd percent of the time will come.